40771, United States versus Alvarado. Ms. Landau.
May it please the court. The issue before the court is whether Mr. Alvarado, who received sexually explicit images of his teenage girlfriend, received an unreasonable sentence of 170 months. The sentence was imposed by a judge who improperly interfered in plea negotiations, directed the prosecutor to investigate avenues that might garner Mr. Alvarado a higher guideline range, demonstrated bias in favor of the minor, telegraphed her intent to sentence Mr. Alvarado to 15 years before a plea was even entered, and wanted to make sure that all objections would not reduce the guideline range below 15 years.
What's bias in favor of the minor?
Asking the minor's mother to testify and sympathizing with her on the record.
That's bias under these circumstances?
I believe so. Okay. The judge is there to listen, and she could have certainly acknowledged the testimony, but there was no reason to say how horrible it must be for her daughter or make it appear as though she had already decided the case. Perhaps on its own it might not be enough, but in the larger context, I think it's significant. Made gross assumptions about all child pornography offenders and applied those assumptions to Mr. Alvarado, such as his inability to be rehabilitated, that he must have had other victims or shown the images around, that he was necessarily a pedophile, and beyond that, she called him derogatory names. And that was just at rearrangement. In all, I counted 30 improper statements.
Well, that's not a point on appeal, so why don't you get to the merits of your argument?
Actually, Your Honor, that is a point on appeal as I've construed it, because my point is that he was denied an unfair sentencing because the judge had already decided the case at rearrangement. So it's relevant to see what happened there. And if that's not enough, at sentencing, the judge again demonstrated bias by identifying with the victim. She pronounced a 180-month sentence without hearing from defense counsel, which she then stepped back from on objection. She didn't address the mitigation, which the prosecutor agreed with, in saying that this is an unusual case that merited.
I'm sorry, Ms. Landau, but you raised 2 points on appeal. Procedurally unreasonable because the court did not adequately explain its sentence. Now, lack of adequate explanation is sort of contrary to what you're saying now, which was that it was biased and predetermined. Substantively unreasonable because the court gave, quote, too much weight to the guidelines, among other things. So why don't you just talk about those things, okay?
Sure, but that's...
I mean, if you had raised it or moved to recuse, then we would have a separate issue on appeal, but I just don't see attacking the judge as a valid situation on appeal here.
Well, Your Honor, actually, I did raise these issues in the facts of my brief and also in the arguments themselves as part of the...
I read that, but why don't you confine your argument? You're using up your time. Go to whether it was procedural. Argue what's in your brief here.
Your Honor,
procedurally unreasonable, substantively unreasonable.
I'm explaining why it was substantively unreasonable.
Well, that is interesting.
Okay. My main argument is that he did not receive a fair sentencing process, and thus he did not receive a fair sentencing result, because the point of 3553A, Rule 11, Rule 32, is to guarantee fairness. These are ideas grounded in the notion of due process in the Constitution, and while there are certainly technical violations that people assert using these rules and statutes, this is not a mere technical violation.
This is a within-guideline sentence.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. But that sentence is only entitled to a presumption of reasonableness, and I think under the issues that I presented, it's not reasonable. And the government responded on appeal by filing a brief that could have been filed in any reasonableness case. The government didn't deal with the issues that I presented about the unfairness of the sentencing process. And as the government even recognized before the district court, this is an unusual case. Mr. Alvarado entered into an illegal but genuine relationship with this girl, and his offense is a product of that relationship. The number of images are very limited. There's one video and two images. And there's no indication, as the government said, that Mr. Alvarado was seeking child pornography as a general matter. This is not, as in many cases, a power relationship. Although Mr. Alvarado received the cross reference to the production guideline, it's not something where he was in an abusive relationship with somebody who had no power.
It's not abusive to have a little girl strip naked and do sexual things on a video that can go anywhere in the world?
Well, it's not a power relationship in that they were never in the same room.
Oh, good. I mean, that's your characterization of it, but one can see, as a mother or a grandmother, one can see the opposite view.
Absolutely.
Society sees it differently, as a matter of fact.
I understand that, Your Honor, but the government asserted, and we agree, that this is an unusual case, and the judge treated it like it was the absolute mine run of cases.
The only thing, well, not necessarily. I mean, again, the judge was entitled to draw inferences, and unfortunately, you know, the only thing that I saw in the brief that weighs against what you, the weighs in favor of what you say is that he sent this text message to her, "You're too young, I could get arrested," but then he did try to meet her at the mall.
I think the facts were a little bit unclear as to the circumstances of that meeting.
But the judge was entitled to draw inferences.
Absolutely, and if that's all the judge had done, I wouldn't be here today. The judge had already decided this case as of rearrangement, and that is improper. If the judge had really listened to everything,
then you should have moved to recuse her. That's really, what else is in your client's favor that's in the PSR? You say it's unusual. I think one could infer it's unusual, but one need not infer, and therefore the district court's findings are entitled to clear error review.
Clear error review? I know, Your Honor, it's an abuse of discretion review in this case.
All right, fine. But the fact findings that she implicitly made are shielded by clear error.
Well, I'm not.
And the overall determination is that the within guideline sentence is presumptively reasonable.
I'm not challenging the factual findings. What I'm saying is that this case, I understand that you don't believe that it's unusual, but I've never seen a case like this. The United States attorney who handled the case said it was unusual, and he sees a lot more cases.
Okay,
I assume.
And what's unusual, when you say it's a love relationship, well, they meet in a chat. I don't know much about modern love relationships in chat rooms, so what's so unusual about it?
Because child pornography offenses generally don't involve a real relationship at all.
But this is an online relationship. It's not, I mean, we've seen appeals of a lot of cases like this, where fellows solicit young women over the, we had one on NOA yesterday. A guy solicits who he thinks is a young woman, a minor, over the internet. Turns out it's a policeman masquerading as a minor.
Right.
It happens all the time.
This is different, though. The factual scenario that you've outlined,
yeah, because this was a real girl and not a cop.
Well, more importantly, it's because that he thought she was 20 when he contacted her. That's a big difference. That means he wasn't out there looking for something he shouldn't have been looking for. He fell in love with her. They didn't just correspond it was all by text and phone. But when he found out she was 15, he tried to cease the relationship, but obviously he couldn't. And
he tried to meet her after he knew she was underage.
He did. He was in the same, I don't know how much effort was put into trying or whether it was happenstance or what exactly.
Well, her mama was with her.
She was. But he never was in the same room with her. And the images were not distributed anywhere. There's no indication he had any other kind of child pornography, which the prosecutor said was highly unusual. And there's no indication that there was any.
But he transferred it to his second phone.
I don't know how it wound up on the second phone, and I'm not sure that it was pornographic images. I think the record is unclear on that point. There were images of her. and some of them were duplicated from the other phone, but there's not, the PSR doesn't actually say that they were pornographic images. I think that would have been in violation of his bond.
Could I ask you one thing before you finish? Would you address the length of the supervised release?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm glad you asked that. The court indicated that it had never not given lifetime supervised release. And because of the unusual nature of this case, a lesser term is warranted. And I'd like to correct myself, if I may. In my reply brief, I indicated that the standard of review should be plain error as to supervised release, but Mr. Alvarado did object at the conclusion of the sentence to the length of the sentence, and the supervised release is part of that sentence. So I think the judge was fairly on notice that Mr. Alvarado intended to challenge the length of his sentence overall, not just the length of imprisonment. But something less would, because of the nature of this case, because there's no generalized interest in children, Mr. Alvarado would be sufficiently deterred by a lesser term of supervised release.
Is the minimum 5 years?
Yes, Your Honor. And just something under life, you know, 5 years, 10 years would be sufficient under the facts of this case. But I think it just shows that the district court was in this sort of autopilot mode to treat this case like every other case, even where Mr. Alvarado doesn't show the characteristics that concern us. And the assumptions the judge made were also incorrect. There's no indication that people who merely receive child pornography are more likely to be recidivists than any other offense. In fact, with treatment, which Mr. Alvarado didn't have the benefit of, they are usually able to rehabilitate themselves better than other offenders.
Well, is there a recognized distinction between a child pornographer and a pedophile?
Yes. In the case of receipt or possession, yes, Your Honor. And
Mr. Alvarado's age right now?
25.
Well, and, you know, I think part of what motivated the court was that the government dropped the more serious charge.
Well, that's not her decision to make about what charge to drop.
She can decide whether to accept a plea agreement or not.
She can.
And
but
she did accept it, so don't complain about that. But she can also take, I mean, there was no dispute that he would have been guilty of a more serious charge.
I'm not sure that that's true, Your Honor.
You asked a little girl to strip naked and perform sexual acts on a video, and that's not sexual exploitation of a child.
It would depend on the elements and what
could
be
proved. I'm sorry to make you so argumentative over things that don't count, so go back to your argument.
I apologize, Your Honor. I think it does count. I would very much like to answer your questions, but we don't have the proof that would have been offered at trial. I would like on remand to ask for a new judge. I don't think that this judge can be impartial in this case. She was not a neutral arbiter. She was a partisan in this case. And so Mr. Alvarado would request that the court reverse his sentence and remand for resentencing
Is he an alien?
No, Your Honor, he's a citizen.
Okay. Right. Okay, Ms. Wilson.
May it please the court. Alvarado has failed to show under plain error review that his guideline sentence is procedurally or substantively unreasonable. Under no circumstances has this court been deprived of meaningful appellate review, or was he sentenced unfairly. He simply disagrees with his sentence. As stated in our brief, we believe that plain error review applies to a host of these complaints. And if they had been lodged below, this would have avoided the recurring problem of neither the court nor the government receiving notice and being able to correct or respond to these arguments. In any event, it's important to look at this rearrangement in context. As Judge Jones pointed out, it was an extremely favorable deal. Judge Jack was very disturbed by this plea. What it was doing was allowing him to plead to a lesser offense, if you will, the receipt, and drop the more serious offenses of not just exploitation, but 3 counts of possession, as well as drug trafficking, because that's how he was stopped. He was stopped at the border, and they found approximately 21 kilograms of marijuana. And at checking his phone, the videos were found. So he was getting a very favorable deal. And Judge Jack was very disturbed by this, and so they explored a host of these attendant issues. I don't think that she had made her mind up, but she was asking about the sentencing and trying to distinguish between the two major offenses, the exploitation and the receipt. And all of that needs to be taken in context. And when you circle back and you get to the sentencing, what you see is the sentence was based on an individual assessment, and here's why. Judge Jack did exactly what she wanted. The prosecutor wanted 180 months. The mother wanted 240 months, which was the statutory maximum. And Alvarado wanted a below-guideline sentence of 120 months. Nobody got what they asked for. She imposed a sentence of 170 months. And the way that she got there was, again, listening to the facts, and if you look at the sentencing hearing, she asked a lot of questions. And in Alvarado's brief, he made it sound as though that she tried to prevent defense counsel from arguing in a mitigation, but that's not true. What happened was she did get set to impose the sentence, and when the defense counsel reminded her that he had not had the opportunity to speak, she apologized three times. And it was a result of his arguments that she dropped the sentence an additional 10 months. And things that are important to remember here is I think the facts are fairly simple, but in relation to the arraignment and then to the sentencing, what we know is during the rearrangement, the gentleman was rolling his eyes, and Judge Jack found his behavior, which she says on the record, very disturbing. So we have his conduct at the rearrangement that was offensive. In addition, of course, she had the PSR, and then during sentencing, she was asking these additional facts. And what we know for a fact here, it's undisputed, that he knew that the child was 15 when he asked her to produce these sexual videos, and that he did this again 5 weeks later. As I said, he was stopped for the drug offense. They seized his phone, and 5 weeks later, he's caught with another phone. And as I recall the record, some of the prior sexual stuff was on that phone in addition to other information. But regardless, if I misspoke, I apologize, he's continuing to communicate with this girl. This court had, there was a case recently, I apologize, it's not cited in our brief, it's Bacon at 646 Fed 3rd 218, where this court specifically recognizes the problem in this area with child pornographers and child abusers and whatnot, and says how there's an increased risk of recidivism in this area. And while he may not have had any history, what we see with this girl alone, twice he's gone overboard with her. This 15-year-old girl, he's 9 years older, it's just totally inappropriate. And back to his personal conduct in relation to the court proceedings, during his allocution, which Judge Jack more or less determined was half-hearted, more importantly, his own lawyer said, give me one second here, I apologize. His own lawyer said something to the effect that based on his client, the client's allocution, even defense counsel said he could tell from the allocution that, quote, maybe Mr. Alvarado doesn't fully get it. And that's on the sentencing hearing at 19. So you have his sexual behavior, if you will, and then you have the lack of respect for the court and not fully understanding or appreciating his type of misconduct. All of that is extremely important. As you know, this is not a within-guideline sentence, but it's even more important to know that this sentence is only 2 months above the bottom of the guideline. Only 2 months, that's all. And as I said before, nobody got what they wanted here. Judge Jack independently sentenced him. And as this court knows, it infers that the judges considered the factors for a fair sentence and whatnot. But Judge Jack also stated during sentencing that not only had she considered the 3553A factors, but in particular the history and characteristics, the need for deterrence, and to protect the public. Judge Wiener asked a question about the lifetime supervised release. Well, it's a sex offense, and so the guideline recommendation for that is lifetime supervision. And again, going back to what the FPD said during the sentencing hearing, Not only did he not object, but he anticipated. He said that his client was facing lifetime supervision, and this is the FPD's words, that it's designed to protect the community. So even the FPD recognized that this is often the case with these child offenses. And that was on page 20 of the sentencing record. And while Judge Jack may have said at the rearrangement that she often does that, that is fairly commonplace because that's what the guidelines recommends for sex offenses. And as this court said in Bacon and otherwise, this is a very, very, slippery slope area in terms of recidivism. It's not even a legal point. It's common knowledge. It's in the paper. We see this all the time. And so at the end of the day, what we have here is the failure to rebut the presumption of reasonableness. Just to sum up, the district court clearly listened to Alvarado's arguments for a lower sentence. It sustained the objection to distribution, so that knocked off two levels. Then it heard and acted on the mitigation arguments. It lowered the sentence 2 months. It didn't honor anybody's sentencing request. And Alvarado, at the end of the day, basically received what he had bargained for, because in the plea agreement, the government had agreed to recommend a guideline sentence, and that's what he got, 2 months above. So under all of these courts' precedents, I think when you put this all together, there was nothing left to say under Rita. So unless this court has any further questions, I will yield the remainder of my time.
Mr. Alvarado is not here through me because he just disagrees with his sentence. There is a fundamental problem with the process that produced this sentence. Moreover, the government hasn't explained why plain error review should apply in this case. Mr. Alvarado.
She didn't say it applied to the substantive unreasonableness. She said it applied to procedural unreasonableness, I think.
Well, and just now it sounded like a more general assertion, and I just want to make clear that plain error review should not apply in this case. The judge was made aware of the problems with the guideline at sentencing. The judge was given mitigation that she didn't respond to, and then there was an objection at the end of the sentence as well, based on the prior statements that defense counsel had made, as well as under the factors of 3553A. So the court's review should actually be for just abuse of discretion, not plain error. And I think the government, perhaps unintentionally, is misreading the record. There's no indication that Mr. Alvarado sought or received additional improper images after he was arrested. That would have been a violation of his bond, and to my knowledge, he remained on bond without a problem.
Did he know at the time he entered the plea that the government's recommendation would be 180?
The record doesn't reveal that, Your Honor. But I think Your Honor brings up a good point, which is when the government says he got what he bargained for, there's a guideline range there. The guidelines are not, they're advisory, they're not mandatory. And I'm sure that his attorney would have said, I'm going to ask for less than the guideline range. This is an unusual case. Here are these mitigating factors. The government recognizes this is an unusual case. And he did not bargain for 15 years, although it was pretty clear at the plea that he was going to get 15 years, and he got a sentence just a little bit below that.
Well, even if we assume he didn't know that the government was going to recommend 180 months, is it safe to assume that he knew what the guidelines range was?
Yes.
For that offense?
Yes, Your Honor, he did. It was discussed at sentencing, and it was also discussed at rearrangement.
8 months was the low end.
Yes.
All right. And he got 107.
Correct.
All right.
But in the end, the court said it would wanted to give 15 years, wasn't interested in talking about a charge that would produce a sentence of less than 15 years, and within a few months, that's what he got. So when the government says nobody got what they wanted, the government pretty much got what they wanted, and the court pretty much got the sentence.
Well, your client could have gone to trial.
Could have. He's still
under the charges in the indictment, and then he'd probably be exposed to 20 years. So I don't quite understand what you're saying.
I'm saying he's entitled to a fair sentencing process, and he didn't get it. And when the government says that we somehow acquiesced in lifetime supervised release, I have to dispute that, because we acknowledge the existence of that recommendation to request a much lower prison sentence. So perhaps a longer term of supervised release would be called for if he weren't serving nearly 15 years in prison.
You know, I'm just trying to say this gently, but I don't think it helps a public defender's case to attack the district judge unless you don't attack the king unless you can kill him. And if the public defender's office thought that the judge was biased, the office should move to recuse. Otherwise, predicating your argument on the basis of unfairness, which is not the issues raised in your brief, does a disservice to the office, in my view, as well as just, you know, casting aspersions unfairly on the district judge.
Well,
you argued substantive unreasonableness. So that means tell us about Mr. Alvarado, other than just conclusory, this is an unusual case. I mean, I was just reading over what he was communicating with this woman. It's an awful far cry from what I understood to be true love. It's all porn.
Well,
and so I don't understand why the judge didn't think that 170 months was reasonable, or would think that.
Well, Your Honor,
unreasonable.
I just have a couple seconds, and I want to address what you said. What's in rearrangement doesn't encapsulate their whole relationship. It's only the offense. The love songs and the poetry, which the United States attorney referred to, were not made part of the proffer at rearrangement, of course. It's not relevant. But there's so much more to it than the part that was the offense.
All right. Thank you.